order. This morning we have an informational meeting. The Department of Public Safety and Standards and Training will cover some information today. Please start as you will and identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Steve Weiniger. I'm the Interim Training Division Director for the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. That's DPSST. My colleagues and I are here today to discuss the current state of affairs in the use of force training in Oregon. Law enforcement officers are empowered to use force to ensure the safety of all members of the community. The Department of Public Safety Standards and Training provides basic and advanced training to law enforcement officers statewide to prepare them to perform the public safety mission in their communities. This training includes training on the use of force as authorized by statute and court decision. I would like to take this opportunity to introduce my colleagues today and our presentations. To my left is Lorraine Engelmeyer, an attorney and trainer for DPSST, who will talk a little bit about the legal framework that we provide as far as the training to law enforcement officers and the use of force. To her immediate left is Brian Harvey, the skills supervisor for DPSST, who will describe the training philosophy and provide some examples of the training that we provide. I will bring some unique perspectives from my position and from my background, which I'll explain a little bit more later. And I'm going to talk a little bit about use of force training from a risk management perspective. Ms. Engelmeyer is going to start.
Thank you, Mr. Weiniger. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee. I am a part-time attorney and legal instructor trainer for DPSST. I do work out at the Training Academy in Monmouth. And what I wanted to begin with was sort of a thumbnail sketch of that coursework for our basic police students that we have identified as most obviously connected to the subject matter of use of force. And I mention that because as you look at the list that I've provided, and you'll find it on page 2 of the handout that Mr. Weiniger kindly prepared for us, and which I believe you have in front of you, you'll see that some of the coursework there might not readily appear to be connected to the subject matter of use of force. And in fact, an argument could be made that certainly at the Academy currently, in one way or another, there's always the potential for there to be a connection to the subject matter of use of force in training. But these were the ones which stood out as having, shall we say, a more obvious connection. So, Mr. Chair, if I may, I would like to just briefly walk through this list. I certainly don't intend to read the whole list, but I thought that I would just briefly do that, if I may.
You certainly may.
Thank you, sir. So we begin instruction for our basic academy students with a course called Criminal Law 1. And in fact, the way we currently present our criminal law coursework is we have a scheduling of classes 1 through 9, and these classes deal with essentially all of those criminal code discussions that have been identified by the job task analyses for basic police officers. So in Criminal Law 1, we start talking to the officers about sources of law, and by that I mean Congress-made law, Oregon State legislatively-made law, judges' interpretations as rendered by case law, etc. And for the first time, the basic police student would be hearing about Oregon's statutory definition for deadly physical force. So it's a very foundational class and really only at this point the briefest connection to use of force subject matter. The next class that a basic police student would have, which relates to this subject matter, would be procedural law. Now, this is a very lengthy class in terms of hours of instruction. It's delivered over a day and a half. And the connection to use of force that the student would start to learn about here is the very threshold issue of the nature of the officer's contact with a free citizen. Is it the nature of an encounter, a stop, or an arrest? The student starts thinking about how his or her conduct actually influences a later analysis of what that type of contact is, and then certainly they will start to see the connection with how use of force needed to bring a free citizen under control or to place that person under arrest, how that affects the analysis of their conduct. They also learn about the specific Oregon statutory authorities, which indeed give officers authority to use force to make an arrest. or effect a stop. The next course that our basic police students would have, which relates to this issue, is called Criminal Law 9. Again, the numbering has literally no significance whatsoever. And in this class, really, the student is learning the basics, nuts and bolts, about Oregon statutory authority for not only police officers to use force to defend themselves, arrest persons, and prevent escapes. But the officers are also learning about the statutory authority granted to civilians to use force, to defend themselves, to defend their property, etc. The discussion of the authority of corrections officers to use force is touched upon, but it is a briefer discussion because of the audience. These are basic police officers. Now, in the Criminal Law 9 class, the officers are introduced to the, I guess I'll say, the concept or the reality that there exists federal constitutional case law which touches upon any potential considerations of officer use of force. And so at this time, the officers are hearing about the cases by the United States Supreme Court from 1985, Tennessee versus Garner, and from 1989, Graham versus Connor. And for your convenience, members of the committee, I prepared just the briefest of outlines, which I've attached. I believe you'll find it on your page 3, where I have pulled out from those cases, and as close as possible, this is exact language from the cases, the high points, if you will, from these two Supreme Court cases. And we have found that you really do need to discuss these whenever you're having a conversation with basic officers about use of force. They are presented with the discussion about these cases in the Criminal Law 9 class. Really, I think it could just as easily be discussed, these cases could just as easily be discussed in, shall we say, the civil liability class, because admittedly there is some overlap between those principles and the rulings in those cases. But for present, we advise the students that they're out there in the Criminal Law 9 class. The students also have a class called Federal Civil Rights Violations, and this is the class where students would be introduced to a section of the United States Code, which, quite frankly, members of the committee, most of them have heard about before they came to the Police Academy, and that's Section 1983. And a Section 1983 action is the sort of colloquial term assigned whenever a person files a federal lawsuit alleging excessive force on the part of a police officer. So the students learn about the requirements of that section, and the instructor is even able, hopefully, to give some real-life examples of cases like that and lawsuits alleging a violation of that statute. I do not instruct that course myself, but I understand they have had some good real-life examples when it is instructed. The next course would be a class simply called Civil Liability. And in this class, the students are very much encouraged, and this is actually at the beginning of instruction, the students are encouraged to think very proactively about this subject matter, to think about problem-solving strategies in their dealings with citizens which could actually assist them in reducing the potential for conduct which could give rise to civil liability. And so that is an encouragement provided at the beginning of instruction. Then the course proceeds to a discussion of examples of previous uses of force which have given rise to jury findings of negligence and jury findings of intentional use of deadly force, which of course would give rise to findings of civil liability against the officer and potentially his or her agency. And then lastly, the course concludes with the discussion of vicarious liability on the part of perhaps sergeants and command staff for agencies. For example, things like failure to train an officer or negligent retention, etc. So that, in a nutshell, members of the committee, is the coursework presently provided by the DPSST, Basic Police Training Academy, to our new recruits. And at this time, if I may, Mr. Chair, I'd like to reintroduce my colleague, Mr. Brian Harvey.
Thank you. Mr. Harvey.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, again, Brian Harvey with the Oregon Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. What I'm going to talk about is basically a couple of different areas. One is an overview of the training that we do and how it encompasses some of the concepts that Mrs. Engelmeyer has spoken of. And I will also talk about some major principles of survival skills, some of the major ideas we want to encourage the students to understand. and excuse me, kind of an overview of some of the actual classes that we do in the skills venues themselves. And with that said, if you would actually please turn to your pages 7 of your handout there, there you'll notice that there's a chart there. Try to adjust this here. There's a chart that reflects some of the hours of training. Many of those have already been touched on by Mrs. Engelmeyer. Several of those classes, such as the criminal law, and I actually transposed 8 and 9 together, that would truly be criminal law 9 is the majority of that class that she had spoken of. And you'll see the various criminal law classes displayed. In addition to that, you will see the what I call the DT use of force classroom, which is a defensive tactics use of force classroom lecture. And I'll hit on what that is in a moment here. And along with that, further down, you'll see defensive tactics physical training. And you'll notice on that we have 8 sessions for 4 hours apiece for a total of 32 hours. That's kind of the foundational class they get of how to actually apply these skills. And you'll see a class called computational simulations under that. We have a total of 4 sessions, 4 hours apiece for a total of 16 hours. And a Range 3000 computer simulator class, 1 session at 4 hours, for a total of 4 hours. If you look at our use of force curriculum as a total, you'll see a reflection of 119.5 hours, which, of course, goes to the question commonly asked out of a 400-hour academy, how much time are we spending on use of force? Now, the important point to make about this is it's easy to look at that as 119.5 hours of training. The reality is that's not entirely accurate. And why I say that is due to logistical issues. For example, when someone comes into the computational simulation class, and maybe I should explain what that is. Computational simulation is one of our probably best scenario-based realistic trainings that we're able to accomplish at the academy. During this training, what happens is we have instructors that pose as problem people that the officers have to deal with in a scenario. The instructors are wearing protective suits that hopefully prevent them from getting injured. Doesn't always happen, but that's the ideal behind it. And the students are wearing protective gear. The students are issued all the tools that they would normally carry on duty to choose different force options as they encounter the problem. We have what we call simunition guns, so very similar to a paintball gun, so we can accurately tell if they're choosing to fire and use lethal force. And we have batons, we have OC spray, a variety of different tools that they can use. They're put into a situation where they have to go through the decision-making process to decide exactly how they should handle the problem. It may range from walking away, taking no action at all because they don't have a legal basis, as Ms. Engelmeyer spoke of, to take action, or to all the way to lethal force. And anywhere in between, those various scenarios can encompass. The reason I say there's a logistical problem is the reality is that of a 4-hour session of computational simulation, an individual officer is physically participating probably for about 15 or 20 minutes, just purely because of the amount of time it takes to run each officer through. What does happen is while other officers are running through, the officers who are not are watching the scenarios themselves, which gives them the ability for some vicarious learning. So they are exposed to that decision-making environment during the 4 hours, but they're not participating during the entire 4 hours themselves. So when you kind of look at that, and the same issue occurs with Range 3000. A Range 3000 scenario generally runs about 15 or 20 minutes out of the 4-hour block. So you'll look at some of the limitations, and it's easier for us to think that they're truthfully getting all these hours of actual practice and scenario training. In reality, they're not, simply because of logistics. Our goal when we go through this training is to provide a building block approach to training. We know that the best adult learning model is what we call a building block or part-part-whole training scenario. The more complex the skill you're trying to teach, the more you want to break it down into parts and teach a part of it and then teach the next part of it, try to put those two parts together, and then catalog onto the third part, et cetera, until they're able to accomplish the entire skill. What we find is we're able to see that we're not always successful as much as we'd like to be simply because of the time constraints. We will start off with the intent of putting these folks through the defensive tactics class, the firearms class, all those type of things. Bring in the confrontational simulation at the end, and we will often find that they have forgotten part of the material because we don't have enough time to reinforce it. So that's the limitation we're faced with. The officers do a remarkable job out on the street given the fast pace of training they receive at the academy, and we do a remarkable job with what resources we have in getting them prepared, but there are some gaps. The next thing I want to talk about is some of the major principles, some of the ideas we want to plant in their heads in the survival skills training. The way I look at it is survival skills training is the application of what they've learned in the law classes. We, for lack of a better word, try to front load the information in the legal classes to provide that legal foundation. And then we say, what does this all really mean? And how do we actually apply this? And that's basically what the survival skills venues accomplish. There's a couple of principles that we train on. They're scientific principles based on scientific fact. These are not things that our trainers have just thought up. They're things that have been well researched by various sources throughout the United States and actually internationally. One of those principles is action versus reaction. We know scientifically, and it's scientifically proven, that it's physically and physiologically impossible for a person to react faster than someone else can act. Therefore, we have to teach our officers how to compensate for that. The best compensation we can come up with is tactical modifications to try to buy them extra time to react. If they don't have the extra time to react, they are continuously playing catch-up to what the offender is doing. And so some of the principles we use, for example, is a very widely used one throughout all police training throughout the United States is the use of cover. We'll try to train the officers to utilize something that will hopefully stop bullets if someone is firing at them, although the reality is there's not a lot of things out there that will do that, but certainly will at least create a barrier to slow down the attack that might occur against them. And by utilizing this, it offers them a little bit of time to try to analyze the situation and react appropriately. So there's different modifications we may take to try to address that issue of action versus reaction. The second thing we train them on is the effects of acute stress. And my definition of acute stress is a instantaneous traumatic situation that causes a tremendous spike in a hormone, adrenalized hormones into the body, which correspondingly creates a tremendous spike in the heart rate. Scientifically, we also know about effects that will happen to people under these circumstances. And we train students on this so they're prepared to how to mitigate this and deal with it. As you'll see on your on page 5 is where I'm at. I'm sorry, I didn't reference that earlier. Under elevated heart rate effects, we will see that at 145 beats per minute, complex motor skills start to deteriorate. And that's anything from 145 and a heart rate exceeding anything above 145 creates deficiencies in the officer's performance and their perceptions. Our ideal place for survival is to try to keep the heart rate between 115 and 145 beats per minute, which provides the best survival response. At 150 to 175 beats per minute, perceptual distortions commonly occur. And these are things such as narrowing of vision, what we often call tunnel vision. And this, by the way, isn't exclusive to police officers only. This is also to any human or any person, citizen, police officer, soldier, whatever, that's involved in a traumatic incident. If you think back, if any of you have been involved in a serious vehicle accident, you probably have experienced some perceptual distortions. And of course, as you can see, the perception distortion, narrowing of vision, what we call audio exclusion, maybe some things, sounds aren't able to be perceived, or maybe other sounds are perceived out of the context that they're in. They're much louder or much more significant to the individual, depending on the lighting conditions. There may be some memory distortion. A variety of things can happen. That obviously leads people to think, well, is this person being truthful or not? The reality is that they are perceiving things the way that physiologically they are able to at the time. After 175 beats per minute, cognitive functioning deteriorates. The ability to think through a problem deteriorates and can completely cease at a certain point, depending on the individual and their training level. If that occurs, what happens with the officer is they go on what we call autopilot. They go on a preconditioned response of whatever they are most naturally able to do or most conditioned to do based on training or whatever. Our goal is to try to create a conditioned response in case the officer falls into that level of heart rate from an acute stress situation. We want a conditioned response to help create what we call stress inoculation, which is to be able to have control over the events that happen if they get into that position. Also, the value of good training is the more the officer has experienced the situation in realistic training, the calmer they will stay in an actual real incident. And so that's part of our goal of what we're doing. And I actually skipped over a point here I'll back up to, and that's the survival mentality piece. If you look at what we talked there, as much as folks don't want to like the idea, we have to teach officers to be assertive when necessary. And what we find is, in today's environment, a lot of our hiring that we get is officers who have never been involved in a physical altercation in their lives or any type of confrontation in their lives. And so they don't have a skill set on how to be assertive and how to overcome resistance when they come into the academy. We have to teach that assertiveness. What we find historically, and again, study after study has proven, is an officer who's not assertive and does not take control will generally have one of two things happen. Either they will pay with their life, or they will end up having to use more force later on in an incident than they would had they took control early in the incident and controlled the situation. So the result of not being assertive is oftentimes having to overuse force later on in the incident to try to regain control of it. With your permission, Mr. Chair, I'd like to show a video clip at this time.
Please do.
Thank you.
This, I'll just kind of break down what has occurred here. This young deputy is stopping a person for speeding. Basically, it's a speeding vehicle traveling about 98 miles an hour on a rural country road. He's making a stop, and this is his first contact with the person.
Exactly what happened to Kyle on January 12, 1998.
Real can bone?
Hey, come back here to me. Come on back here for me. Come on back. How you doing today? Good. Come on back here. Keep your hands out of your pockets. Keep your hands out of your pockets, sir. Sir. Come here. Sir, come in.
37 radio 1078.
Come in. Sir, get back.
Where are you from?
Sir, get back. Now, get back. Get back. Sir, get back now.
No.
Get back.
Fuck you.
Sir, get back.
No.
I said now. Get back, sir. Sir, get back.
got out of the truck immediately.
That's the deputy that's being interviewed afterwards?
No, the deputy was killed.
Okay.
That was his commanding officer. So, and this video illustrates a point that I wanted to make, and that is and whenever I show these videos, I use these as training videos, and one of the important things I want to put out there is I'm not here to criticize the officers involved in the situation. They paid with their life to serve their communities. But I think it's very important, and I think this deputy would want other officers to know, there are some severe tactical mistakes that were made by this deputy. And one of the important things is this deputy was not prepared to use force when necessary. And we could analyze this all day, but the bottom line is he didn't take forceful action like I spoke of early in the incident to take control of the situation. these are the type of things, and this is a video we actually use in training. These are the types of things that we try to prevent our officers from the mistakes they're making. What is hard to catch on that brief clip that you saw was there was a point when that individual was brushing at the deputy, attacking him, where the deputy chose to use his baton. And it's hard to see, but you'll actually see him walking onto the camera again with the baton loaded in a loaded position. He struck the person one time. Had he used decisive force at that point and used the baton effectively until the threat was stopped, he would have never been in a firefight with this individual, and the situation would have been controlled. So this is a classic example of underuse of force and not having the proper mentality because of fears of whether he's doing the right thing and various things like that. Several people were interviewed in this, both co-workers, responding officers to the scene, and this deputy's grandfather. And there was a common personality trait with this deputy that everyone spoke of. He was a very, very nice person who never wanted to hurt anyone. He paid with his life because he wasn't able to be assertive when he needed to be. So, and that's just one point I wanted to point out there. Also, what you'll see is you see him mentally overloaded. You see, because he didn't have that realistic scenario-based training to the degree he needed, he went into that point I talked about with the elevated heart rate where his cognitive functioning stopped. And you'll see that by the commands he gives. He gives conflicting commands, and he's stuck in what we call the OTA loop. He is not able to think through the problem and think of any other options or alternatives and how to handle it because he's so mentally overloaded. That's what happens when people don't have a preconditioned response or when they're not calm enough due to experience and exposure through training and reality on the street to be able to handle a traumatic incident that effective to them. So It's easy to look at this tape and sit back and think, well, boy, they're really paranoid at the academy, and they're teaching this from a paranoid standpoint. What the reality is that everyone has to realize, and I'll give you an example here, is on March 14th, 2003, we had a graduating police class 261. Three officers from that police class have been involved in deadly force encounters. This is less than 2 years that these officers are out of the academy. One of them was ambushed and shot in the face with a 12-gauge shotgun and is still recovering from his wounds. It's a miracle he survived. His life has been severely impaired since that time. One of them was attacked along with his partner by an individual with a machete. His partner ended up with 47 stitches and life-threatening injuries to his head from the machete. And the last one, the individual tried to shoot him with a handgun in a garage, and the officer shot that person before the offender could deliver any rounds. These are rural Eastern Oregon agencies. Every one of these is from a rural Eastern Oregon agency. These are not just Portland, metro area, whatever. The reality is we have a crime problem. We have more violent offenders than there ever has been in history, and we have to prepare the officers to survive that. So, yeah, maybe they do get a little paranoid when they come out of the academy, but the reality is we have to prepare that mindset and then try to balance that with getting them to understand that we have to, basically there's a time to bark and a time to bite. And that's kind of the analogy I use with the students. And you have to know when it's okay to let people just come up and talk to you. But we have to get that balance in there. And sometimes that's a challenge in a very short academy to accomplish. So I just wanted to emphasize the point that this type of training video is very realistic to the type of problems that officers will encounter. Although this exact circumstance may be rare, the level of threat is very common. And the other part of that we teach the officers is that there's literally millions of uses of force across the United States that are mitigated without having to go to these drastic levels of force by proper handling of the incident. We only see the few that have gotten really out of hand. If we go on to page 6 here, I want to talk briefly about some of the content of the different classes. The Defensive Tactics Use of Force class, the lecture class, is our first, for lack of a better word, attempt at taking the legal foundation they've been provided in the legal classes and looking at what does that really mean? How do we apply that on the street? And we look at, for example, in the Graham versus Connor that Mrs. Engelmar referred to, there's some specific language from the courts about what they expect out of police officers. And one of those things is that the officers base their actions on the totality of circumstances. So, and this is just a brief outline of some of the things that we cover in the course. It certainly is not, of course, the entire course. But one of the things that we talk about is, first of all, the intent of a police officer's use of force is to gain cooperation or compliance. That's what we use it for. There's times that we're legally required to get people to comply with what we need them to do. We teach them that force is never used as a form of punishment. It is never to be used as a form of punishment, and we emphasize that very heavily during our time at the academy. It is simply used to gain control of a situation. You'll hear a lot of reference and a lot of folks talking about, both in the media and probably at other committee meetings, things of that nature, legislative testimony through the past, that of talking about force continuums. I simply touched on that real quickly because it's very, very important for people to understand that a force continuum is simply a training tool. It is not the whole of use of force. And it's very easy to look at a force continuum and believe that that represents everything police officers are taught about use of force, and that simply is not true. So we use that as a tool right now, but we make them understand that this is simply a training tool. It's not everything you need to consider when you use force. We break down the totality of circumstances, and you'll see there's a couple of lists there. I'm not going to go through all the details, but basically we get the officers to analyze and break down what are some of the issues that they're facing. And two of those are the influential circumstances, what we may call environmental factors, and the other one is officer versus threat factors. And these are the commonly placed things such as the officer's size and strength versus a threat size and strength, and you know, those type of things. Are they outnumbered? Does the threat have a weapon, et cetera, et cetera? So we get them to try to analyze these individual pieces when they make a force decision. The bottom line, what we're trying to teach in that class and the mentality we're trying to impose on the officers is that their use of force, the legal and practical application, is to be reasonable force based on the totality of all the circumstances they're confronted with in a situation. And that's the bottom line, what we're trying to train them to. After that class, we get into a variety of skills venues, and these vary throughout the 10 weeks of the academy class on different schedules depending on what's available resource-wise. So they're not exactly always in the order that you're seeing them. A lot of times they're intermixed. But the bottom line is we basically have the defensive tactics, and as we talked about earlier on the chart, we have 8 sessions of 4 hours each, and that's kind of the skill building. You know, how do you apply handcuffs? How do you use a control hold? How do you search people? You know, those type of things when they're in custody. So that's the breakdown of what that class is, and it's a building block approach to get them ready for the confrontational simulation, which is the scenario-based training, to get that, you know, good mindset of how to do that and hopefully prepare them for that. We also, in firearms, out at the range, we go through use of force training. The issue with firearms is it's very difficult to go out and have realistic scenario-based training because you're firing live rounds. And obviously, we're not going to put people in a situation where they're going to get injured by live rounds, so there's a huge safety factor out there. That, of course, then limits drastically your ability to encompass that area of training out in that venue. So what we do is we try to at least limit it to selection between a threatening target and a non-threatening target. So they have at least that decision-making part to try to be able to identify the difference between the two. And we're able to do that in a safe manner at the range, but that's about how limited it gets at that point. So a lot of it is basically skill building to get to the ability to be able to handle it, again, in a confrontational simulation later on in the academy. We also have a Range 3000 system, computerized simulated system you may have heard about before. A very, very good tool, although it does have some limitations. And obviously the giant limitation is it's a two-dimensional system. We aren't able to have that three-dimensional depth perception, movement and counteracting to the movement and those type of things. What it is a tremendous tool is to go from the lecture format of the classroom and some of the basic skill building as an intermediary before they get to the confrontational simulation to get that first level of practice and do that part whole training model that we've spoken of. The goal of all of our skills training is to try to get the officers to reach tactical competence. If an officer is tactically competent, it provides them with far more options on how to handle a situation. And the more options they have to handle a situation, the less the likelihood is that they will overuse force or use unnecessary force, because they have a better, for lack of a better word, toolbox to choose from on handle a problem. And that's the goal of what we're trying to do. And Mr. Chair, if it's all right with you, I'd like to show another clip of a video here. So,
go ahead.
Thank you. This is an officer who stopped an individual for DUII, and it's in their state. And he stopped the individual, and he's out there, and he's basically stalling for time until another officer gets there so he can effect an arrest. And in doing so, he starts to tell the offender about what the implied consent law speaks of, about what will happen after he's arrested, which isn't a great technique, but that's all right. But this will give you an idea of the person he, the encounter, and how it unfolds.
Okay.
chemical test in your breath for the purpose of determining the alcoholic content of your blood. If you refuse to take this chemical test, your privilege of operating a motor vehicle will be suspended for a period of 90 days or 1 year if it is later determined. This is a second, but wait a minute, hang on a second. You come right here for a minute. I understand that, Mr. Pouncey, but I place you under arrest, and for my safety, I can't let you live that.
I'm not going anywhere. Don't grab my goddamn foot.
Mr. Pouncey, you hear me? I placed you under arrest. I'm not going to let you go back to that vehicle.
Did you feel anything?
No. Never saw it. I remember looking at my gun holster to put my flashlight up. I remember looking at that. The next thing I remember is waking up with him on top of me.
Rex Bishop had been knocked unconscious by the first blow and was taking a brutal, potentially life-threatening beating when a small miracle occurred.
Let me through, bitch! I tried to tell you.
Whenever I come to, and what I did not know at that time was the truck driver had come up and had struck Mr. Pouncey across the back of the head with a flashlight. It was a 5D cell mag light, one of the real long ones, and he had to strike him with both hands across the back of the head with that flashlight three times
before he got his attention.
After the second time he hit him, you'll hear some.
The purpose of that video clip that I wanted you to see was a couple. As one, again, this is an officer who didn't use good tactics in handling the situation that he was involved in. And there's a variety of things we use in this for training that we would speak to the students about warning signs that the person is going to be assaultive. The second issue, and an important issue that I point out to the students when I use this video, is we often think of repeat offenders as the folks that cause a lot of danger to us. This individual was a railroad engineer with a high-paying job, a very minimal criminal record, and two of his children present, getting arrested for a routine crime of DUI. These are the types of threats that officers face daily out on the street, and these are the type of things that we prepare them for and how they handle a situation. And lastly, another powerful point of this video is to show that under an adrenalized state, whether it be the threat of the officer, how much it takes to stop someone. And as you heard them, the officer talking about, the truck driver comes out and hits this person three times in the back of the head with a 5D cell flashlight to get him to stop. And then it doesn't even knock the man unconscious. So people under an adrenalized state can take a tremendous amount of physical force before they'll stop their actions when they're in a hostile, adrenalized state, especially if they're under the influence of alcohol or drugs or that type of thing. So we use that tape to demonstrate many of those points as we show it to them. So I'd like to close with the message that an important point of this is all of these survival skills are complex skills that have to be developed. It takes a tremendous investment to build a foundational level of competence. Then it takes another investment to keep these skills fresh. These are all perishable. If we don't continuously practice and maintain these skills, and the officers don't do that, or their agencies don't do that, those skills will deteriorate. If the skills deteriorate, what happens is the officer no longer has that ability of tactical competence and have as many options to choose from. As the skill deteriorates, their confidence level in using it deteriorates. They will not choose it under a stressful moment to use because they don't have confidence in it. So they'll resort to what they feel will work, which oftentimes is a higher level of force because that's the only thing they're confident will work at the moment. So it's imperative that these perishable skills are maintained. I'm going to turn it back over to Mr. Weiniger, and he will speak a little bit to the ramifications of not maintaining that skill set with the officers. So thank you very much.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, again, my name is Steve Weiniger, and I'm the interim training director at VPSST. From the presentation here and from your own background, I'm sure you understand that all law enforcement officers, their agencies, the chief executive officers, their insurance providers, and the communities that the officers serve have a real vested interest in ensuring that their officers know how and when to use force properly. I have to give you a war story because it was my first exposure to potential use of force incident, and it taught me a lesson that lasted me throughout my career. I was about 19 years old, was an Explorer Scout riding with a Washington County Sheriff's deputy who responded to a domestic disturbance. And as we walked from the patrol car towards the house, the gentleman in the house came out of the house, stood on the front porch with a butcher knife in his hand. The deputy stopped, drew his gun, and started talking to the guy. And several times the guy threatened the deputy, the guy raised the knife. The deputy was in a good position. He was far enough away. He told me afterwards, he says, I never really felt threatened, so I didn't feel that I needed to use deadly force in that situation. He was pointing his gun at him the entire time. And he was able to talk the guy out of the knife and was able to resolve the situation. We took him into custody without incident. But it taught me a real important lesson, and as a matter of fact, it's one that I observed throughout my 32-plus year career in law enforcement, and that is that law enforcement officers don't want to use force unless they have to. And the last half of my career I spent as the police chief for the city of Tualatin. And in Tualatin, we started monitoring the use of force, I think, in about 1990, right in that area. And so I had the opportunity to review literally hundreds of reports of officers' use of force. And unfortunately, also from my experiences, not every situation can be resolved as the sheriff's deputy was able to resolve that one. There are just times, like we've seen here on the video, that officers have to use force to protect the community and the people that they serve. The key for this, though, is that we need to ensure that our law enforcement officers know when and how to use force. Since my retirement, I've been working with a number of law enforcement agencies in risk management. And in looking at the risk side, the civil side of law enforcement activities, including the use of force, and there are three keys to risk management when it comes to law enforcement. One is policies. They've got to have good policies and procedures in place to direct the officers' activities. The second is training. Officers have to be trained, and they have to keep their training up in all aspects of their job. And the third is accountability. Their agencies have to hold the officers accountable for their activities and actions when they're on the job. Ms. Engelmeyer and Mr. Harvey have described a little bit about the training that we provide law enforcement officers at the Basic Academy. And as we work towards expanding the Basic Academy from the current 10 weeks of training to 16 weeks when we move to the new facility, we'll be able to enhance that training that the officers receive in their Basic Academy in all areas, including use of force. DPSST has also established some ongoing training requirements so that officers don't just, you know, receive training at the Basic Academy and then receive nothing for the rest of their career. The requirement right now is that officers have to receive a minimum of 8 hours per year in use of force or firearms. And we're very fortunate in that. I think that I can speak freely from the number of agencies that I've been involved with over the years that every agency out there exceeds that minimum standard. And that's a very positive thing. However, as Mr. Harvey just stated, to maintain these skills requires regular and consistent training. They're perishable skills. It's like probably the best example I can come up with driving. You don't drive a car for a while, you get back into a car and it's like, oh yeah, you know, I got to remember this, I got to remember the turn signals, you know, whatever it may be. They're skills that, as long as you use them, they're very, you know, you're very good at them. If you stop using them, they deteriorate over time. However, there is another piece of this training, though, that is equally as important. It's not only having the skills, but it's knowing when and how you're authorized to use force. And the state of the law and use of force is in a constant state of change, is probably the best way to put it. It's evolving, and it's being redefined on a regular basis through court decision. And so officers have to have that information as far as what is the current state of the law concerning use of force in order to properly use force. This tells us that officers need, on an ongoing basis, not only the skills training, but the knowledge training in use of force. And right now, unfortunately, we don't always have the level of training that we should have available to all of the law enforcement officers in the state of Oregon. At this time, I think we're done with our presentation, and we'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Questions? I hear the criticism that there's more training required to become a barber than a police officer in Oregon, and I'm assuming, or I'm guessing, or wondering, maybe I should say, there's certainly a lot of on-the-job training, is that not being counted when people use those kind of figures when they say a barber's getting more training?
Can I answer that, Mr. Weiner?
Go ahead.
Yeah, the reality is that DPSST currently doesn't have the authority to dictate what an agency itself trains in. Basically, we have a field training manual that's required to complete, but there's not a time limitation or time requirement placed with that. So what happens is if you went to, say, just theoretically Salem or Portland, a large department with a good amount of resources for the training venue, an officer will commonly get assigned to a field training officer and do a very complete field training and evaluation program, generally 15 to 17 weeks, maybe 6 months, depending on the size of the agency, a significant amount of time and investment. Unfortunately, if we ship someone off to just theoretically Burns Police Department, they may go there and have a week because they just don't have the resources, they don't have the coverage, they don't have the ability to place someone in there. So we can only guarantee the basic training that they get at the academy, the 400 hours of basic training. And that analogy that's used was used as a comparison of what is required to be licensed as a barber in the state of Oregon, which I don't remember the numbers, but I think it was like 700 or 800 hours or something like that of actual documented training to achieve that level. But here we have people out there making life and death use of force decisions, and there's a core training of 400 hours that are required of them, and then whatever they can get from their agency at that point on. So it is a realistic analogy to use.
Okay. Thank you. And then on the Tennessee versus Garner, you know, that the academy was teaching up till 99 that you could shoot a fleeing felon as opposed to the 1985 decision. I tried to pass a bill last year to bring Oregon statutes in line, but it got hijacked on the other side for political reasons and never came, or when it came back, we killed it. But we'll try that one again, too, to try and bring our language up to current standards.
Mr. Barker, Chair Barker, lapse in etiquette. My apologies.
No problem.
I was so good until right there. Mm-hmm. The discussion regarding Tennessee versus Garner and our statute 161239, sir, that you attempted to amend through House Bill 3426, I'm very familiar with the history of that debate in the last session, and I wonder, Mr. Chair, if part of the difficulty with the apparent perhaps disparity between the statutory language and what Tennessee v. Garner says is the simple fact that Tennessee v. Garner was a civil case and not a criminal case. And I think that discrepancy does tend to make the analysis somewhat confusing, if I may humbly say. I find it confusing. But I have seen, Mr. Chair, that there are going to be some attempts to look at that issue this session, and I assure you I'll be following that very closely as well.
Right. And then, Mr. Harvey, I was going to ask you, you talked about the effects of somebody involved in these traumatic incidences. Miscounting the number of shots, kind of thing you're kind of alluding to, where your mental, you get the tunnel vision and so on. There's been some arguments over when you interview an officer who's been involved in a traumatic incident, if you should require an interview right away or if you give them a day or so to settle down. And at least the things I'm familiar with, about a third of the people involved in those are highly disturbed, and about a third are mildly disturbed, and about a third are fine. So, and it would be my opinion it's best to wait a little bit so you don't have somebody saying things in their altered state of mind, so to speak, and that later would make it look like they're trying to lie or something. Okay. Just your opinion.
Yeah, correct. And let me say that I can certainly speak an opinion, but I think it'd be more appropriate. One of the leading researchers in the United States right now in this area is Dr. Bill Lewinsky from a place called Force Science Institute. Never been a police officer. He's simply researched police issues. And He speaks, in fact, in many articles, and I've referenced some of them in a reference list I gave you there about the effects of memory under traumatic incidents. And you're correct, Mr. Chair, on the studies have shown that different people have different levels of effect, based a lot of on their experience, how calm they're able to stay in the incident. But undeniably, the studies continuously show that memory improves with time. From the incident, that because of those perceptual distortions and the excited state that the person is in under the various stimulus of the hormones, those type of things, that the perceptions will be distorted initially after the incident. The brain will start to sort that out as more time goes by. So I think the science shows that the best practice is to allow some time for that to dissipate. And there's actually a lot of discussion about post-traumatic stress syndrome and the way that the how long it takes for these hormones to come back into the body and the process to get them there, et cetera, et cetera. And there's a whole area of research in that. But the bottom line is that, yes, the memory does improve with time getting away from the incident. And that, by the way, is an important thing for us to remember for the citizens who we're interviewing that are involved in traumatic incidents also. So that's another angle that we need to teach police officers, is if you have a citizen involved in a traumatic incident, their distortions may be out of perception from exactly how someone else perceived it, and we need to give them some time to let their memory get back into whack, for lack of a better word. So that's a very accurate observation.
And I know the academy right now is very short in time period, so you really have to cram a lot of stuff in there, but hopefully we can expand that some. And I was wondering about healthy choices in I'm sure you promote the exercise and so on, but like the food. There's a Dr. Blum who was a psychologist for Southern California, a lot of the Southern California police. He highly recommended the psilocybin, psyllium, yeah, right. Psyllium, the metamucil kind of things, because of the noradrenaline that's dumped in these states. And he talked about that if 1 through 10 is a scale of adrenaline pumping, for somebody who's just a normal police officer going to work, when they put on their uniform, they're at about a 6 or 7 already. And then when you hear the call on the radio of somebody saying, I need help, you immediately have these huge adrenaline dumps, especially if you relate back to similar circumstances you've been in, and how bad that is on people's health. And so I just wondered, do you have a program about healthy living there, or are you hoping to put that in when we give you some more time? Because I know you're crammed.
No, great question. And the answer is, we have a very minimally acceptable program at this point because of time constraints. So we do a very good health and fitness as far as exercise, healthy eating, those type of issues you spoke of. And then we also have a traumatic incident class. Unfortunately, it's very brief. What we'd like to do is not only expand it to the officers, but to their families also. Mm-hmm. Because as you well know, sir, the effects of these issues get carried into the home also. And so if we can teach the family how to help deal with that also, it creates a healthier individual all around. So you're absolutely right. That's a huge area of concern for us. And we want to address that more. But right now, literally, our health and fitness class is 4 hours, and the traumatic incident is 2 hours. We spent a total of 6 hours of actual teaching in this topic. It's this very, very imperative topic that affects the performance of the officers on the street. And it's interesting you referred to Dr. Blum, because Director Mittis asked me to bring a copy of his book and pass it out to the members. So with your permission, Mr. Chair, I'll do that. So.
Thank you. That'd be great.
Super.
And Mr. Chair, if I may, I might add that the director has provided copies for those of us who are involved in the training on the subject matter for basic police students at the academy. I'm presently reading the book that you are being handed this morning. I'm finding it very, very valuable, not only as a trainer, but as a police spouse. So I'm very glad that the director has had the foresight to make this available to us. It's not a book I had previously read in my prior ramblings, and I'm finding it quite helpful. So I look forward to seeing that particular piece you mentioned.
Okay, great.
Fiber, who knew?
Yeah. And there was one other thing I was thinking of along those lines. Oh, I was going to suggest that you might take a look at the model of the employee assistant program Portland has set up that really prevented a lot of, we were seeing an increase in post-traumatic stress cases, and they set up a program sort of in conjunction with the retirement and disability system, although we separated so that people could go to the EAP without having to be seen by everybody else. And I think that program, working with people early on, we were able to really reduce the incidents we were having of people ending up going off on disability, just as a suggestion, with Babette Heffley's is the from the pension board. She'd be the one to start with, but then they have a good EAP program there. Yeah. Any further comments or questions? Anything?
Chair Barker, if I can go back just one thing to the concept of officer fitness. Within the expanded 16-week academy, we're going to be spending more and more time on the whole concept of fitness and expanding that, because we know that it's important for officers in use of force situations to be able to deal with the kind of physiological reactions that occur. And so we need to start emphasizing that so that officers throughout their career are able to deal with that better. So I wanted to make mention of the fact that that is part of that expanded academy training.
Okay. Further. Well, thank you very much. It was very informative, and we really appreciate you taking the time to come over and spend the morning with us.
Thank you for your kind attention. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for the book.
Yeah. Further, the committee is adjourned.